Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. There's been a lot of resistance to Donald Trump's cabinet nominees, but one of them barely squeaked by. Betsy DeVos, the new Secretary of Education, was Donald Trump's most contentious nominee. DeVos has virtually no experience in public education. Instead, she has funded and supports religious schools. She once described education reform as a way to advance God's kingdom. In a Mother Jones profile, education reporter Christina Rizga summarizes DeVos' career by writing that she has spent a lifetime working to end public education as we know it. And then we've got the budget. Donald Trump's budget calls for $9 billion in cuts to public education. It sets aside $250 million for what's called a new private school choice program. So how will this play out on the local level over the next 4 years? How are Bay Area schools preparing for what could be very big changes in policy and significant funding cutbacks? It is spring break in San Francisco this week, so we're going to be talking with some educators today. Susan Solomon is Executive Vice President of United Educators of San Francisco. They represent 6,000 employees at the San Francisco Unified School District, including teachers, counselors, and others. Susan taught kindergarten for 8 years in the district, and Susan joins me in studio. Hi, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Rose.
We're also joined by Eric Guthertz. Eric is the principal at Mission High School in San Francisco. Eric has been working in public schools for 30 years as a teacher in East L.A. and South Central Los Angeles, a high school for homeless teenagers in San Jose, and then at Mission High. Hi, Eric. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, good morning, Rose. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. We have so much to talk about. Let's start off by talking about the budget. Susan, this is a budget that would potentially cut $9 billion from the education department. What really stands out for you the most in this budget?
There are a few things. One is the budget is not as strong as we'd like, even without the cuts. When you compare California to the rest of the 50 states, the 49 states and District of Columbia, California comes out 46th in how much we spend per student. And that is with Proposition 30 and 55, which brought more funding into California. So it's already difficult to find the funding we need and the resources that we need to best provide services for our students.
What is per student spending these days?
So I just looked that up. It is just a little under $9,000 per student, which is $3,500 below the national average. And so we're starting from a deficit. And then to contemplate that the state of California, which currently gets close to $9 billion a year in federal funds, that just could be devastating for San Francisco and for California.
And what really stands out for you when you think about what teachers are facing right now? And whenever we do shows about schools with educators, they just talk about having large classes, not having much support, having to spend their own money on basic necessities.
So all of that is still true and within the context of the housing affordability crisis in San Francisco. So we're already having a hard time holding on to educators here. And then we look at the kinds of supports that they really need. The San Francisco Unified School District adopted an excellent resolution 3 years ago for safe and supportive schools to address institutional racism. And our union supported it, but the resources aren't there to really fully implement it. And then there's the issue of special education, already an underfunded program. The federal mandate, and remember, this is the program, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, that Betsy DeVos didn't really even know about. Mm-hmm. And it's supposed to fund schools, students with special needs up to 40% for the school districts, and it's at about 16%, and it's never been more than 18%. It's
What explains that?
A lack of will and the typical, all too typical underfunded mandates from various governmental agencies. So there's already not enough money coming from where it's supposed to come from. So the school district does supplement the program. But we already, again, struggle to make sure that our students who have individual education plans get what they need. And I'm proud to say we're in a school district that it includes students with special needs into general education classrooms.
Right,
Eric?
Hi, Susan.
Hi, Eric. How you doing?
Good. Good to hear your voice.
Same.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Mission is a good example of fully inclusive school in which students with IEPs are absolutely included in the mainstream and general classes with lots of supports. And I think there's no question that right now it's a challenge as it is. Given these cuts, it would be a massive challenge. And given the fact that clearly DeVos doesn't even know necessarily what IDEA is or didn't know, I'm not sure the protections are going to be there at all.
Hmm. Eric, the budget will undoubtedly change, but what really stands out for you?
Well, I just, for me, what stands out is the devastation of public schools in our country. Mm-hmm. And I just, I don't want to sound alarmist, but I mean, I'm, you know, looking at H.R. 610, for example, and this idea that there's some folks out there that are really ready to dismantle ESSA and actually divert all the funds or lots of funds to vouchers in private schools is deeply alarming. I mean, I think Susan said it beautifully. I mean, I think our board has been very supportive of our work, and I think the city as well, the mayor's office has been supportive. But these are difficult financial times, and as a state that's already deeply underfunded as it is, these cuts, I think, would be devastating. And I think Susan already mentioned it, but, you know, the number one reason that we lose teachers in Mission, there's no question, is housing, is the ability to afford to stay in the city. I can't even imagine how we're going to navigate that given these kinds of cuts that are coming.
You mentioned H.R. 610. This has been getting a lot of attention on social media. Can you tell us about this bill? It was introduced by Iowa Representative Steve King.
I don't want to pretend I'm the expert. I'm really on the ground. But from my reading of the bill, it basically does three things. I mean, number one, it dismantles Every Student Succeeds Act, you know, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, sort of the next wave of that post-MCLB. It redistributes funds for vouchers. I believe it demands that the states use that money solely for vouchers. And it has a weird little addition, which is it gets rid of nutrition standards,
right,
or some of the nutrition standards for the lunch programs. So on the one hand, we'll wipe out schools, but then we'll feed the last two children that are remaining terrible food.
Susan.
And my other reading on it is that I think it's a simple majority to pass it. So it doesn't need the two-thirds. So I don't know where it stands right now, but there's a really good short YouTube like animation video that shows you everything in detail, and it's quite alarming.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, just because there's so much going on, and it's hard to keep up with everything. So we'll put information about H.R. 610 on our website. It looks like it hasn't been passed by the House yet. Is that right?
No, not yet.
Okay.
And the other one, when I was looking up 610, which I think is more devastating, there's also H.R. 899, and that may just be out there. I don't know, but basically, it's a one-sentence proposal to terminate the Department of Public of Education.
Wow.
And even though I'm hopeful that won't go anywhere, when you do consider that the person who is in charge of public education in the United States has no belief in public education, it is something alarming.
Right.
Tell us about the conversations that you're having with your colleagues and how you're all responding to this and preparing for what's to come. Eric?
So I think at Mission, we jumped really quickly because, again, there are so many facets here that could be alarming to the state of education and specifically to our students and our families. Admission in all the schools in the city and in the state. So, I mean, I think for us, we have begun to have conversations around how are we going to continue to support our immigrant students. Mission is a one of the newcomer pathways to the district, so newly immigrated students come to Mission High School as one of, I think it's five or six choices now, and in the district. And we see, I'd say, about 30% of our students are newly immigrated to the country from all over the world. We have a large percentage of undocumented students. We have a large number of Muslim students. So immigration has been a major area to look at, both in terms of how are we supporting students through this time, through in terms of fear and anxiety, literally looking at how we can find more therapeutic supports, more legal supports for our students. A big one is around college. Certainly in California with the DREAM Act, we have many, many of our immigrant students and our undocumented students utilizing that to go to college. But is that right now we're advising to move forward with it, and it's college season right this minute. Kids are getting their offers from the various colleges, but does that put students at risk? So those are some of the big areas that we've been looking at, and even in terms of legal rights for our families, and of course in terms of protections if immigration officers were to arrive at the school.
And I understand that students are fearful and parents are nervous about letting their kids go on annual college visit,
right,
field trips, for example, to Southern California.
So every year we've raised some money. We've taken the last 3 years of our fourth year. I lead a group of students, about 35, 40 students, on a Southern California college trip. It's super fun. We get a bus and we go about the week after school gets out. And we see colleges throughout Southern California, and you're giving kids a good, nice experience. You haven't lived, really, till you stayed in a hotel with 35 teenagers. we had the applications were due this week, just before we left for spring break, and I had two students come to me wanting me to call their families because they want to go on the trip, but they're afraid that even if they just get on the bus to go down to Southern California, could they be at risk for immigration officers looking for them?
Wow.
And so, I mean, that level of fear is so great that even a simple field trip is frightening.
Mm. Susan, what are you hearing from other schools?
So very much the same thing, the concern and the fear. On the flip side is the hope, and people, we are seeing educators in larger numbers than ever show an interest and a concern and a willingness to be trained, to get out there, whether it's in the streets or at meetings, to address concerns about immigration and how can we protect our students and how can we help our families. And so that's the hope we have to hold on to, that the people who are with the students every day will be assisted in knowing what to do. And I feel that the San Francisco Unified School District has, is out there too, is trying to get people educated on what can and can't happen. Some of it's pretty scary because at this point, according to the Homeland Security, schools are still considered sensitive locations, which means that's not a place where ICE should be showing up. But we already know that we're seeing examples in other cities where that's changing. And, if ICE were to show up with a warrant for a student, that would be something that we couldn't turn them away from. So we can send them downtown. At our schools, we don't have to give out information. But if they were to come for a student, we might not be able to keep that student safe. And that is really frightening. And, just a quick story. Right after Trump was elected, it wasn't just among young kids, elementary school kids. It was certainly immigrant students who were crying and worried. But on the Hunters Point Bayview District, there were African American kids who were asking the adults in the schools if they had to go back to Africa. And I'm talking about families who I'm sure have been in this country longer than my family has. So that's what's out there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the day after the election, it wasn't 2 minutes I walked in the building, and I literally walked down the hallway. I had student after student after student. This is African-American students, Latino students, immigrant students, even white students, particularly some Jewish students, concerned for their own safety in our country now and wanting to know if they were safe in the building.
Wow. That is Eric Guthertz. He is the principal at Mission High in San Francisco. He's been working in public schools for 30 years. And Susan Solomon is executive vice president of United Educators of San Francisco. They represent 6,000 employees at the San Francisco Unified School District. Susan taught kindergarten for 8 years in the district. And it is spring break this week. And when that comes around, we like to invite educators on the show to have a conversation about what it's like in the classroom, what it's like in school, and what it's like under Donald Trump. And we'd love to hear from you. If you are an educator, how are you dealing with these issues, the immigration fears, the pending budget cuts? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you're a teacher or a parent, if you are involved in your school, if you care about public education, what changes have you seen and how are you preparing? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. My teacher friends always say that they have to be taxi drivers and counselors and bringing in socks and shoes and food. And now they have very similar stories about immigration. And what do you expect to happen in the coming months? Because the Chronicle had a story just on Monday about civil rights groups asking California's attorney general to investigate dozens of school districts across the state of California that require parents to provide their kids' social security numbers, their citizenship status, and other sensitive information, such as when they entered the country.
Right. I saw that, too. And Eric, I'm not sure, but I don't think we asked for social security numbers in
absolutely
San Francisco,
not.
Right?
No,
yeah,
no, we do not ask. You know, in no way, shape, or form, and we need to keep it that way.
Right.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the challenges that we have, and one of the reasons in San Francisco we don't want to ask for more information than is needed, is that we feed our students in San Francisco,
right,
breakfast and lunch, and in some schools now they get dinner as well.
And right, we do.
And there are families in the past who have been fearful of filling out any form if it's going to in any way indicate that they are not documented. And
right,
so the struggle between making sure we get that paperwork in so kids don't go hungry at school and assuring parents that they won't be more vulnerable if they do that paperwork.
Right.
And Eric, what sort of changes have you seen as principal at Mission High, just in terms of demand for things like meals at school and the need from the students?
Well, that's a good question. I think the need has just risen. And I mean, Mission High's free and reduced lunch numbers have gone up in the last few years, not down, which is interesting because we're on one of the most gentrified corners in the city, you know, at 18th and Dolores. But we went from about 5 years ago from 60% free and reduced to about 75%. And we actually think it's probably higher than that for very similar reasons that Susan just mentioned, that some families still are a little fearful of filling out the forms. Mission is now a CEP school, which I wish I could tell you what that stood for, but which means that we hit a threshold that means that every child in the building now gets free lunch regardless,
right,
so which is great. And suppers and whatnot. But what we're seeing recently is a larger amount of need. I mean, interestingly, right after the elections, we saw a wave of newly immigrated students to the school. And one of the things that we noticed were some students and families that were actually held in detention centers. One was in Utah and another was, I believe, in Arizona. And they were released, I believe, by possibly activist judges or counselors, came to San Francisco. I think, with the fear that they're trying to find a sanctuary city is my understanding, which is great in that way. But what we saw was a huge increase in need for things like backpacks, paper, toiletries. So we've actually been working with some of our foundation friends, some of our community partners, and looking for resources to actually buy materials and supplies for students that just simply don't have any. And we're actually doing a program in the next few weeks where we're going to buy a couple hundred backpacks and fill them with, books, binders and paper and even toothbrushes and toothpaste. But we're also finding needs for things like groups and therapeutic care. Students are coming with lots and lots and lots of trauma at this moment, and it's not being reduced by the new administration. It's being increased by that. So lots of needs. And then, of course, families reaching out. We for more supports for themselves as well.
We did a show recently about an incredible documentary called Bad Kids, and it's about a school right outside of Joshua Tree, about 5 minutes from the entrance of Joshua Tree, where kids who've been suspended or just don't fit into society, called the, quote, Bad Kids, go to school. And it was an incredible documentary. I hope everyone can see it. It is now available on Independent Lens. And it just really gives you a view into what goes on in the classroom. Because you often have the media talking about education without talking to teachers or without really talking about what happens in the classroom. And unless you're an educator, you really don't know, especially with public school. Eric, what kinds of changes would you like to see to ensure that you and your teachers and your staff and your students are actually supported?
That's a good question. I think it's happening. I mean, something Ms. Susan mentioned earlier was around this sense of hope and folks, I think, now waking up a little bit and working to be more mindful and supportive and active in terms of support, ensuring protecting public education. We're seeing that a lot. So I think the more that the community, the teachers, administrators, the city come together and really take a stand here and say, look, public education, I'm going to sound very corny here, but public education is absolutely the backbone of our democracy.
That's right.
I believe that at the depths of my soul. And it is absolutely under attack at this moment. And I think that, but the flip of it is I think it's actually turned a light on. And I think there is this hope. And I'm getting phone calls and emails constantly saying, what can we do to support the classroom? What can we do to support teachers? I'm finding teachers actually coming together in even more collaborative ways to figure out how they can to increase supports of both the psychosocial supports and academic supports for students. Lots and lots of collaboration around helping students academically piece together and think through what is going on in terms of their civil rights, in terms of the history, and in terms of how a democracy is to work. So I think in some ways it's odd to see both this sort of dangerous time or this unsettling time, but also to see that it brings people together with a collective vision that I think is quite beautiful. And at Mission, we have this, you mentioned this idea of not knowing what it's like to be in a classroom unless you really talk to teachers. And I think Christina Rizga, who wrote that book, Mission High, and you mentioned her in the beginning, I think she really nails it. So somebody who's interested, shameless plug here, but I think that's a really good start. But I think that, under Mission's vision of anti-racist teaching, I think that lots and lots of people are coming together here at Mission and across the city to say we are going to do well and right and better by our students.
And that book, again, is called Mission High by Christina Rizga. She's a reporter with Mother Jones. We had her on to talk about that book, and it is a really amazing book. Susan, before we go to break, what would you add about the changes and the support you'd like to see?
What we would really like to see more support in the form of some of the things that Eric touched on, but making time available for teachers and other educators to collaborate and supporting our students through more training for teachers and paraprofessionals, counselors, school nurses in the best ways to approach the serious issues that students bring to school so that they can succeed in school, and especially in light of the fact that it's another Trump target to get rid of some of the block grants that go to training and focusing on restorative practices in schools,
right,
which is something that's critical for our students and for the success of their teachers and staff. So seeing more of that, I think we're going to have to turn to local and state revenue initiatives. It's clear that we have to if we're not going to be able to depend on the federal government. And there are organizations and activities going on to make sure that happens. So the Alliance to Reclaim Our Schools now, which is a national coalition of coalitions, and United Educators is part of it, has a revenue campaign going on. How do we increase revenue for public education? And it is something that is of great concern to our members who are educators. How do we make sure we have enough to help our kids?
Right. Let's take a call before we go to break. Let's hear from Anne in San Francisco. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. It's actually Pam.
Oh, hi, Pam.
San Francisco.
Sorry.
And Thank you so much, teachers and educators, for coming out on your break to talk about schools. I wanted to make a comment about the wonderful work that is happening at Buena Vista Horace Mann, a public school in San Francisco. Right after the election, we had a march down Valencia Street, and the talking points that the teachers and educators gave were around building inclusion, not walls, which was completely consistent with the values of our school. And everyone was told that immigrants would be protected in the school, which is consistent with the values of the school. And that, I understand, has been something that has been communicated to people by faculty and staff. And I've checked in with teachers about that at Buena Vista. And I also wanted to say that it's just incredibly important for parents and guardians, and even if you're not a parent, to support local schools. Teachers need so much help for all the reasons laid out in this program today, and that's incredibly important to make up for the shortfalls that public schools are experiencing.
So I was on that march, Pam. This is Susan. And it was great. It was the March Against Fear, and there were hundreds of kids with their families and marching around the mission. So those are those moments of hope that keep us going.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Eric, wasn't there a walkout at Mission High, a student walkout?
There was a very large walkout. We lost happily, joyfully, I hate to say it, but I'm so proud of the students. Over 500 students walked out. I believe it was that Friday, and it was incredibly powerful. It was absolutely student-led. The district was very supportive. They actually had some people out there making sure kids were safe. I will tell you that I'm not just a principal at Mission. I'm also a parent of a student, and I got a text at 9 o'clock on my phone saying, Poppy, I'm walking out. Are you okay with that? So as parent, I was fine with it, and as principal as well. So I think that that is true, that there's a tremendous amount of student activism right now, and students really grappling with what the implications are. You know, we talked about for immigrant students, for the issues around racism that have come up in the campaign, sexism, misogyny, and I think another area we haven't touched on yet is the attack on LGBTQ students as well. And so that was part of the walkout in addition, and I think we'll see what comes of it, but student voice at the center, I think, is critical, and I couldn't agree more with the caller. Parents are also very important in this work, and our school site council, for example, has been very active in trying to figure out how to support immigrant students, LGBTQ students, et cetera, with their work as well as we move forward.
How do you concentrate on your schoolwork if you think that your parents are going to be deported?
Oh, I mean, that's a great question, right? Susan, I mean, I think this is one of the central issues, because if you're fearful for your daily existence, how do you make sure you're doing your pre-calc work?
Wow. Right, how do you keep it important? How do we help kids believe that it's still important?
Right.
It's a challenge, and that's where we go back to what kind of the supports that we need as educators.
Right.
How do we make sure we learn how to give that kind of support?
I mean, I do want to say one thing about that. I do think, as I mentioned before, I mean, I think this has gotten to almost a critical or crisis point. I think it actually has turned on a light for a lot of students that public education is, I don't want to quite say sacred, but it is this right that they have that they need to take seriously, and I think I'm seeing that. So while I do think there is a fear factor, absolutely, I have seen students really rise to the occasion academically as well, but I do think that balance will be difficult in the long run.
Eric Guthertz is principal at Mission High School, and Susan Solomon is executive vice president of United Educators of San Francisco. This week is spring break in San Francisco, so we wanted to bring on a couple of educators to find out what they're facing at school under Donald Trump and also how they're dealing with potential immigration raids. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call, which is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. And you can always tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, live news from the BBC in London. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will be marking the Transgender Day of Visibility by speaking with trans people about resistance. In this current political climate, trans people say they're using their newfound visibility to mobilize trans people against oppression. We'll be talking about that tomorrow, and then Friday, it's our media roundtable. Today, we are speaking with educators about what is happening in our public schools. We've got immigration raids, potential immigration raids. A lot of students are afraid that their parents might be deported. And then we have major budget cuts by the Trump administration. The budget calls for $9 billion in cuts to public education. And Betsy DeVos is the new Secretary of Education. In a Mother Jones profile, education reporter Christina Rizga summarizes DeVos's career by writing that she has spent a lifetime working to end public education as we know it. We'd love to hear from you if you're an educator, a parent, or if you just care about public education. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Susan Solomon is Executive Vice President of United Educators of San Francisco. She taught kindergarten for 8 years in the San Francisco Unified School District. Eric Guthertz is a principal at Mission High in San Francisco. He's been working in public schools for 30 years. And now I would like to welcome Chayla Delgado to the show. Chayla is a teacher at Coliseum College Prep Academy in East Oakland. She teaches government and economics to middle and high school students, and she's a member of Teachers for Social Justice. That's a collective of educators. Hi, Chayla. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Thank you for taking some time out of your school day, because I know that Oakland is on break next week. We've been talking about how students are dealing with the potential that their parents could be deported. We've been talking about the budget and what's to come. What are you and your colleagues really concerned about right now?
Well, you know, our school is about 75% Latino, and so we, and many of those students are first-generation students. So we also experienced a lot of fear and loss the day after the election. We have a lot of students not come to school because they were so scared to come outside even. We did circles in all of our classes and had students just express feelings. A lot of our middle schoolers, you know, really just came to school crying and needing reassurance that things would be okay for them. So I think we're seeing, we're seeing sort of a climate of fear, and I teach seniors in particular, and a lot of our students are undocumented, and so there's just a lot of uncertainty about what will happen for them next year with DACA, and it's been really hard for me as a teacher to keep up with what to tell them, because, you know, in the past, I sort of, we worked really hard to educate ourselves about how to support our undocumented students with college admissions, and now we sort of don't completely know what to do.
And this is a college prep school, Coliseum College Prep Academy in East Oakland. And as you said, DACA allows students to have college ambitions. And what are they thinking? Because we were talking about earlier with Eric about how some students, their parents didn't want them to go to Southern California to check out colleges for fear that they might be stopped.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a huge concern. A lot of our students feel much more pressure to stay close to home. We have, you know, just a lot of, questions about whether they should even file for DACA because, you know, once they have DACA, you know, the government has very clear access to information about them being undocumented. And so it's been a really tricky thing. I mean, I think there's been fear at every level from sort of just applying to college, applying for financial aid, And yeah, as you said, even visiting colleges and going out of town, it's been a time when a lot of our students, their families are really trying to hold them close. And that's been just really difficult in this moment, in, you know, what is already a very stressful time for young folks, you know, which is the college application season.
You teach government and economics to middle and high school students. How is this affecting their ability to concentrate and study?
Yeah, I mean, I think we definitely saw immediately after the election just a lot of, there was a lot more tension on campus. There were definitely, you know, we're a small school, so we don't tend to have a whole lot of fights, but there were definitely more conflicts generally. And I think, you know, it was a hard time. And I think it's continuing to be a hard time, particularly for our older students, for whom this is kind of constantly on their minds.
And here in San Francisco, per pupil spending is just under $9,000, $3,500 below the national average. What does it look like in Oakland?
Well, I mean, we're in the middle of a huge budget crisis right now in Oakland. So, you know, we basically had an abrupt departure of our superintendent, Antoine Wilson. 2 years into his contract, he left for D.C., and, you know, the sort of reporting on it has varied, but we are currently somewhere between $8 and $25 million in debt as a district.
Wow.
So, like, our poor people spending what it is supposed to be is already not very high, and, I mean, it's also a year that, you know, we have been fighting for a contract raise for several years that was just in negotiations when this happened. And currently, our budget in Oakland is completely frozen. So we cannot spend any more money on student activities for the remainder of the year. So everything we've had planned, and I mean money that was set aside for student field trips, is officially now gone. The district has taken it. So we're all having to do individual fundraising for our students' graduation and the end of the year rafting trip that we usually take. So it's been pretty disheartening over here in Oakland.
You know, Susan, our assistant producer Helena Murphy is from Ireland, and she cannot believe this is happening in a place like the Bay Area that has so much money right now.
Right. So San Francisco has a larger budget than some countries do. I can't name the countries, but I remember that report. California, depending on the latest report, is the 6th to 8th largest economy in the world, if we were a country. And so the word I just wrote on my notepad in big letters and circled it is priorities. This is all about priorities. In Oakland,
right.
I mean, how ridiculous, how heartbreaking the story that Shayla just told.
Yeah.
And in San Francisco, we are also in contract negotiations, and we need to see a raise just to keep educators in San Francisco.
Right.
We also need those resources I was speaking of earlier to support our students, and it has to be about setting priorities within what is a limited budget. But if the students don't come first, what are we here for? I mean, it's just, as a society, we have to, if we're going to say, although I guess we don't hear this as often as we used to, that children are our most precious resource. If we believe that, we have to live that. And,
right.
And there are ways to do it. We can do a parcel tax in San Francisco, which we're talking about again. We could, as a city, not just the state, but as a city, tax corporations so they pay their fair share and close the loopholes that exist. There's a lot of money there. And, you know, one thing that we hear people say sometimes is how especially the tech companies in the Bay Area should be donating more to schools. And the big problem I have with saying that is donations come and go, and they come with
right.
strings attached. That's why fair taxation is really the way to generate revenue, and the money's there.
Yeah. I agree so much with Susan about all of that. And yet, as a principal, my number one job is to make sure I make good on my promise to support our students at the very highest level. That's like my moral oath, right?
Right.
So given that, as a principal, my number one job is to make sure I'm figuring out how to get resources to the students and to the teachers and the families in the building. And so I think all of those pieces are important, parcel tax, working with the city, and the city's been supportive. I could not agree more about the need for a raise for in the contract negotiations for teachers. It is critical in order to retain teachers in San Francisco. There's no question in my mind about that. I see this, again, as I mentioned earlier, as the number one reason a teacher might leave the school is because they have to leave the city. But given that, I think you have to be scrappy as an administrator. And so we created our own 501c3 foundation that we've been building for quite a while, sort of in anticipation of some other budget cuts, but it's actually been very useful now. And it's not, you know, we're not generating millions of dollars by any stretch, but what we're able to do is reach out to communities, to some of the tech companies, and some folks in the city like-minded that are trying to figure out what to do. How do we support the students given this time? And so we're actually seeing a little bit of an increase there, and I think we'll continue. So I do think it requires us to be very creative and thoughtful. And while I do agree that that money is soft money that just, you know, you can't count on it, right now, we need what we need.
That is also true, Eric. I can't disagree. We're not going to turn money away either.
Right.
Yeah. The LA Times had a story recently about how over the last 4 years, per capita prison costs have jumped from $49,000 to $64,000 annually. So in San Francisco, it's $9,000 per student, and in California, it's $64,000 per prisoner.
I don't know if we need to say anything else besides priorities. What are we doing? And if we don't educate our students in the way they deserve, that is the school to prison pipeline,
or the school to homeless pipeline.
Yeah.
Because I have a friend who trains teachers in Mission Potrero, and she said they are living in deep poverty. Some live in their cars. Really traumatic experiences at home. And she said, if we don't get a handle on this, the students that I am teaching and helping are going to be homeless in 10 years.
Right.
And it's already what they know. I mean, it's so what resources will be there for them? And that's what I think sometimes when we talk about how teachers are struggling to afford to live in San Francisco, what does that mean for people who don't have a job the way that teachers have a job? I mean,
right. Or even, I'm just thinking of our paraprofessionals.
Absolutely.
Right, who I think do incredible work every single day in the classroom, working particularly to support our inclusive practices.
Couldn't do without them. Absolutely.
Yeah, you can't do without them, and yet I do wonder, it worries me, right?
Yeah.
How do you survive in the city like that? And so that's our context anyways, regardless of what's happening at the federal level, right? So then you have to add that on, and you're like, oh my goodness,
right?
Not good.
Right. Yes, so many paraprofessionals have two or three jobs just to make ends meet. And sometimes, and many of them are the sole support for their families.
And paraprofessionals, can you give us examples of the jobs they do?
So they are assist teachers in the classroom primarily. And as Eric said, the program for inclusive practices for students who have special needs, the largest percentage of paraprofessionals work with students with special needs. Some of them also do some advising as well. And
some of them have three jobs to make it.
Right.
Chayla, what would you add just in terms of the struggles and the changes that you'd like to see?
Yeah, I mean, I think the tricky thing about school funding is that it's a vicious cycle, right? I mean, so I think that part of the DeVos agenda that I feel the most afraid of is privatization. And I think that, you know, you have conservatives have constantly sort of been perpetuating this narrative that funding doesn't matter. It's that schools have mismanaged our funds. It's that it doesn't matter. If you work really hard and have high standards, a school can make it with nothing. And I think, you know, there are small exceptions to the rule of schools that have, you know, done really amazing things with very small budgets. But in general, if you look at any study, more funding does actually make a difference.
Right.
And when we talk about student performance, I mean, the primary predictors of student performance are still socioeconomic status and race. And so
right.
I think we're in this situation where schools are very often blamed for social inequities that are really, you know, sort of society-wide, right? I mean, we're talking about kids who are being pushed out of our cities in both Oakland and San Francisco as rents have risen. So we're struggling with that in schools and then being blamed for it when our schools aren't able to perform. And so I think what I really struggle with as an educator is that we need more funding, and we also need to broaden the conversation about what does it mean to still be looking at schooling as the great equalizer when right. we know everything our kids are up against. And I think, you know, the public schools certainly have never done as well as we should by low-income kids, by kids of color, but there's sort of this exaggerated narrative about the extent to which we're failing,
right.
that, you know, if you look at the literature, has actually been debunked. I mean, there's some great work by these guys, Berliner and Biddle, from back in the day, but essentially it's like as more and more kids have taken standardized tests, the scores have dropped, right? Because it used to be only very high-performing kids took those tests, right? Other kids were sort of shoved into woodshop and whatnot, and that's why the scores looked like they did. And so now that we're having higher expectations for all students, we're able to see inequity more and more, right? So, like, in which on the one hand is great, we can actually look at it and focus on it, but on the other hand, it's been used to blame public schools and right. say how badly we're failing, and hence what we need is, you know, alternative systems like charters, which what I'm concerned about, particularly in Oakland, is that they've very much been sold as this solution for particularly for kids of color. And I think if you look nationally, they've not been that solution in many cases, but they sort of, that's how they're branding themselves. And so I feel just a lot of concern about that as a teacher of color, as a public school teacher, as a parent of kids in public schools, that it's something that there are, in some charters in Oakland are doing good work, but many of them, there's all kinds of shady and unaccountable things happening, and they're not being checked. But that's the DeVos agenda, is the expansion of voucher and charter programs.
What's interesting is a number of charter school CEOs, including Richard Barth, CEO of the Kipp Foundation, they wrote a letter to the Trump administration and said, do not boost our budgets while cutting education. They wrote, we realize that expressing concerns about a budget that benefits our schools might seem counterintuitive, but we want to join with all of those who are fighting to defend public education as an essential pillar of our democracy. We will ask Republicans and Democrats to reject these proposed cuts and will double down in our commitment to teaching our students to value hard work, compassion, and caring for the greater good. This was signed by a number of charter school CEOs.
Well, there's a little glimmer of hope, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, charter schools do receive public funding. They are, in their own way, public schools. They just aren't accountable as non-charter public schools are. But there's a possibility for alignment.
Eric, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of more in the middle here on this one. I have seen charters that I think are absolutely unaccountable and do devastating things and make phony promises to families. But I've also seen some that are decent, and I think it's okay to offer a range of kinds of schools within the public realm, not to the detriment of making sure that public education exists for our students, right? And so it gives me a bit of hope to think that the Kipp folks wrote that letter, and it makes me think that, you know, we can have this sort of positive coexistence with some of the charters. I think for me the concern is when the wheels come off and all of the money is going to privates and charters, and we haven't really even talked about what that voucher system actually looks like. Because according to my reading with the H.R. 610, it seems like every family would get the same amount of money. So if you were going,
right.
for example, to a private school and you have very, very low income, you get, I'm making this up, but you get $5,000, and then a family with a middle or high income gets the same amount of money. Who's going to actually be able to access that school, right? And it's not going to be the low-income family. So we need to make sure that we're continuing to support the baseline public education of our students, and if the charters are, some of the charters are saying we agree with that, that's beautiful.
We have a caller, Catherine. We're almost out of time, so we can't take your call, but she wants to know where people can donate. And I know that some teachers are doing GoFundMe campaigns to raise money for basic supplies. But what's the best way people can get involved and donate?
I know that some teachers use Donors Choose, but also go to your local school in your neighborhood and ask what you can do to help. I think that's really a good way to do it.
Yeah, again, shameless plug, come to the corner of 18th and Dolores.
There you go.
We have a foundation set up. We have other means to support the students as well. So if you're interested, Mission is certainly willing. And then obviously there's your local school as well.
And Shayla, what would you add?
I think going to your local school is really key. And also, I would add, and if you live in a wealthier neighborhood, maybe go to a school in a less wealthy neighborhood.
And
you can donate there.
And final thoughts, Shayla? We have about 30 seconds.
I think just about DeVos, I have a lot of concerns about privatization. And also, I think that we are seeing an interesting possibility for folks working together. So I think, a lot of us who've been challenging privatization for a long time are now seeing people who haven't been paying attention all of a sudden pay attention because it's so clear that DeVos is part of Trump's agenda. And so I think there's a lot of exciting potential for political work with folks who have been less activated around education issues.
Shayla Delgado is a teacher at Coliseum College Prep Academy in East Oakland and a member of Teachers for Social Justice. Eric Guthertz is the principal at Mission High. He's been working in public education for 30 years. And Susan Solomon is executive vice president of United Educators of San Francisco. They represent 6,000 employees at San Francisco Unified. Shayla, Eric, and Susan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for what you do in our public education system. We'll definitely continue doing many more shows about this. And thanks for calling in. Thanks for your emails. Coming up tomorrow, we are marking the Transgender Day of Visibility by speaking with trans people about resistance. In this current political climate, trans people say they are using their newfound visibility to mobilize trans people against oppression. 8 trans women of color have been murdered in the United States this year already, and 80% of trans students say they feel unsafe at school. The trans community says with more visibility comes more understanding. That is tomorrow. Your Call is produced here at KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us.
KALW is a media sponsor for the Moth Grand Slam, where winners from the San Francisco and Berkeley Story Slams compete for the title of Grand Slam Champion. This ultimate battle of wits and words happens at the Castro Theater Tuesday, April 4th at 8 p.m. Tickets are available at the door. Information at themoth.org. The BBC is ending its production of World Have Your Say, so beginning next week, from Monday to Thursday at 11 a.m., we'll be bringing you On Point with host Tom Ashbrook. Learn about this and all of the other changes to our programming, including the rebroadcast of Your Call, which is moving to 8 p.m. You can learn about the schedule starting in April at kalw.org. Live news from London is next here on KALW San Francisco.
It's 18 hours GMT. I'm Jackie Leonard. This is the newsroom from the BBC World Service. The British Prime Minister has triggered Article 50, notifying the European Union of the UK's decision to leave.
We can together make a success of this moment, and we can together build a stronger, fairer, better Britain. A Britain our children and grandchildren are proud to call home.
We'll hear international reaction and also voices from around the country.
Wonderful. One of the best days of my life.
If we knew what was happening for EU citizens living in the country and Brits living abroad, then I'd feel a lot calmer.
Also today, the funeral in South Africa for Ahmed Kathrada, anti-apartheid activist and friend of Nelson Mandela.
They shared so many life-changing events. They could laugh together, they could argue, they could discuss very serious issues, and they served as a moral compass for one another.
Thousands of people have marked a week since the attack in Westminster. And what will the new Samsung smartphone do for the company's fortune?